Racism is often described as an individual failing. But today's guest explains that racism is better understood as the result of a system built over generations and even centuries and perpetuated by the stories we tell about it today. She's Dr. Tricia Rose this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to A Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University.
And I'm G. Wayne Miller, also with Salve's Pell Center.
And our guest this week is Dr. Tricia Rose, the Chancellor's Professor of Africana Studies and Director of the Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity in America at Brown University. She's also the author of an important new book, Meta-Racism: How Systemic Racism Devastates Black Lives and How We Break Free. Tricia, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You know, we've had you on the show a couple of times, once pre-pandemic, once in the middle of the pandemic.
That's right.
And so it's great to be with you in person again now.
Post-pandemic.
Post-pandemic.
We hope.
Amen. Amen.
I meant that.
This is a tremendous book. And I finished reading it, and I mentioned to you that my immediate reaction was, this is important. Why'd you write it?
Yeah. Well, you know, the main motivations were the realization that students were coming into my classrooms more and more as time moved on, with less and less understanding about how racism works in society's institutions as a whole. They had a belief that I think was well reinforced by mass media and by, curriculums, that racism was just a personal attitude, right? You're a racist, you have personal negative beliefs about another group of people. And that's not what drives most of the discrimination and most of the significant disadvantages. So we had a schism, right? People would say, is this individual a racist, or what did he or she say that was racist? But then people would put up all these disparities, right? Say, you know, the wealth gap is 10 to 1, and the child infant mortality rate is significant, right? The schools are funded differently. Their performance in schools, dropout rates. And it's almost as if personal beliefs are driving these gaps. And if it's not that, then it must be the people's behavior. So there was this sense of a gap in understanding how to connect why these outcomes could be so profoundly disparate across race between, say, black and white, and at the same time think that all that we have in terms of discrimination is just personal behavior. So I wanted to really interrogate that with the hopes of having a much more productive and informed conversation and hopefully change.
Well, hopefully we have that kind of conversation here today.
Right.
So we've talked to you before about structural racism.
Mm-hmm.
There's systemic racism.
Mm-hmm.
And you introduced me to the concept of meta-racism.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
as a matter of definition before we begin this conversation, can you walk us through?
Brilliant. Thank you for asking that up front, because I'm sure people are being like, what the heck is going on?
Well, they have to read the book.
Yeah. Well, no, even before that, it might seem like a lot. I could fully empathize with that. So systemic and structural are mostly used interchangeably in everyday life, in mass media, among activists, among politicians. There's not a real sense that there's a distinction. And some people will describe what I would call systemic racism, but actually call it structural. So there really is not much in the way of a kind of an agreement. So that's when I dove into systems theory, and we had a little conversation about that. And you realize that while we say systemic, we don't mean systems theory requirements. And so therefore, systems and structures can be the same thing.
Right.
But I'm really clear about how they're different. So a structure, which is what I used to call it until I dove into this for almost a decade, a structure is when any sort of discrimination, in this case, say, racial discrimination, is built in to the operations of some aspects of an institution or society. So when you say structural racism, you don't automatically mean that it is interactive in the way systems are. So structure could say it's built in. It doesn't have to be everywhere. It doesn't have the qualities of systems. And now the four critical things that you have to have for a system to be a system is, first of all, identifiable elements. Mm-hmm. So in the case of society, you'd have to have institutions and governments, policies. You have to have things you can identify, any elements or parts. The second thing is those parts have to interconnect in impact. and they have to be related to one another, that those interconnections are relevant. So if you have a structure that is not a system, you don't have to have interconnections. You could have one institution that's just a mess.
Right.
And the other parts of society don't have to be. See, when you have a system, you are making a fundamental argument that what happens in housing discrimination is connected to what's happening in criminal justice and discriminatory sentencing, and that it's connected to schools, and it's connected to health, and it's connected to the wealth gap, you see. And the critical piece is that systems thinkers, when they say your interconnections are important, they say they produce meta effects. And meta effects are effects that the interconnections produce that are more powerful and impactful than any one part of the system could achieve on its own. So what you're describing is this kind of powerful link, this leverage point that makes a greater, in this case, negative impact than we can begin to describe unless we're using a systems framework. Now, that means we have to ask different questions, which is what I did. But that was a very important insight for me, that these things are connected, that they're not just individual acts by people, and they're not just random, renegade, individual racists running an institution, but that the system is designed to produce these outcomes.
So that approach, mm-hmm. that kind of analysis, allows different insights into what is really going on.
Exactly.
Just give us an overview of the kinds of insights
sure.
that you glean.
Yeah.
We're
going to
get into
huge.
Some of them further in this discussion yeah, you do in the book. Give us an overview.
Sure. So, you know, I was looking for structures first, right? Because I didn't even really understand that the distinction between the two was so significant. This is about, like I said, almost 10 years ago, which is a tragedy. But at that point, I started thinking, okay, let's look for policies that are discriminatory. That's what everyone looks for. But then I realized you things like broken windows policing, things like stand your ground, right, which extended the Castle Doctrine, the sort of practices of racially discriminatory fines and fees with policing and racial profiling. And I said, okay, none of these policies say anything about race.
Right.
This is post-civil rights era, right? We have abandoned the language of explicit racial discrimination. So what you hear is things like a citizen can stand their ground, right? Remember the Trayvon Martin case,
and we'll
use that as
course.
An example, right? And say, well, would he have been able to make a claim for stand your ground if he had shot George Zimmerman? Right? Stand your ground. But when you look at the statistics, stand your ground is never, almost never allowed to be successfully used to defend a black person shooting a white person. There's something like 5 times more likely to be able to go home free if you're white shooting a black person. And then it goes down from there. Black on black doesn't matter. Anytime a white person's in danger, stand your ground from a non-white person, but especially a black person, you find that they are much more likely to be freed, and the black person cannot use stand your ground with the same effect. Now, why does that matter? That means that without any racial marker in the policy, the outcomes are profoundly distinct. So that it becomes a disadvantage that African Americans cannot avail themselves. Why? Because racial profiling is a norm. It's not an exception. So that people believe that they're afraid of black people and that that's legitimate. We should be afraid of black people is the underlying logic. We have no reason to be afraid of white people. That's not true for African Americans. They're like, we're kind of scared of them. There's good reason to be afraid, but it doesn't register in the law. Do you see?
Yeah.
So there are all of these examples. And then there's more that's more complex, but we'll get into it later. But that, I'm hoping that gives you a sense that policy doesn't say anything about race, but they know that it will have a racial effect, because I'm telling you, it wouldn't have been an important policy if it had did the reverse.
Right. So in researching this book, you reviewed hundreds of policies and laws to reveal that, I'm going to quote here, the vast majority involves some combination of containment, extraction, and punishment of black people.
Yeah.
Tell us what that means. And again, we could do a whole show on those terms. But they may be new terms to some people in our audience.
Absolutely. So let me go back up one little step because I think it will help crystallize for people.
Yeah, sure.
So when I went and looked at all these policies, you know, about 75 to 100 of them in health, things like, you know, access to local hospitals, quality care, you know, questions of treatment. You know, for example, black people have been taken off the kidney lists by people and brought down lower for reasons nobody understands. So I started thinking, okay, if is it all about individual policies? And if so, how can I figure out the interconnections, right? So it's at that point I realized that things like disparate sentencing, right? We know black people have been sentenced longer for the same crimes. We know that they're also policed more, so they're more likely to be identified as criminals because they're constantly being surveilled and policed, right?
Of course.
And now, then I realized that this policy means that when you've been convicted of a felony, you are not eligible for any number of public services. So you can't live in public housing. You can't, you know, avail yourself of, say, other kinds of housing support or any other, you know, food stamps. They basically say, permanently, you are persona non grata, which, of course, flies in the face of the point of sentencing. You're supposed to be a citizen when you get out. But what happens is, because there's such a high poverty rate among African-Americans, much higher than whites, something like children, are more, 38% of them are going to be poor if they're black, only 5% if they're white. So you have a disproportionate number of families in subsidized housing who are African American. That when their children have been policed at this level, and then they cannot come back and live at home in any kind of subsidized housing, they largely end up homeless. And that is one of the reasons why black people make up 38 to 40% of the homeless when they make up only 13% of the population. So you're seeing this interconnection, which you, who would make that interconnection, right? That these things are unnecessary. You don't need that housing rejection in order to punish someone. They've already gotten out of jail. But what it does is it connects the housing to the homelessness, and to this sort of permanent criminalization, which we're seeing now. People are upset there are all these homeless people. And then they're also more vulnerable to, you know, mental health issues, because living on the street is extremely stressful.
You make a very important point here, which is when you're released from prison, in the manner you're describing, it's not only the individual who is released who is punished.
That's right. The family.
It's the family. It's children. It could be older people. It could be parents.
That's right.
It's the family.
Right. Now, you magnify that.
So it's a much broader effect.
Much broader effect. So why I'm starting there is because I didn't realize these interconnections until I dug deep into each policy and asked this question. First one is, what does the policy say it's for? Second big question is, what actually happens?
Yeah.
Well, and so when you start seeing the what happens, then the second stage is containment, extraction, punishment.
Your explanation of the way the GI Bill after World War II so favored white veterans as opposed to black and non-white veterans was absolutely staggering to me. We could spend an entire episode talking about that too, but I wanna get to some of the other specific cases that you talk about. One of the things that one of my key takeaways from the book is that you describe systemic racism as racism hiding in plain sight. I don't know if we want to talk about that in the abstract or if we want to get into a specific case. Maybe we go a little bit deeper on Trayvon Martin.
Yeah.
But how is it that the systemic element of racism makes it possible for us to not see what's really happening?
Yeah. That, you know, systems are very powerful because they organize society in such a way that the outcomes appear natural, even when the outcomes are the opposite of what the purpose of the system says. So we say we're a democratic system. We say we're an egalitarian society. You ask most people, whites, 80% would say we're either racially equal or about to be. And so, you know, those numbers are pretty high. And yet here we have all of these institutional ways that significant discrimination is going on. So because it's part of the norm, it requires that people reject everything they know about how society's organized, or at least be curiously critical in order to get at the truth of what's happening, right? And so that's one of the reasons why it can hide in plain sight. And one of the reasons, say, the Black Lives Matter and the George Floyd moment was so resonant was because there had been a series of cases of murdered, you know, highly, you know, beaten and other forms of violence against a very visible group of people over 10 years, approximately. Pretty much starts with Trayvon Martin. At this sort of highly visible, recorded documentation of just gunning people down without even a conversation. And that opened up the door about, well, how could that be? What makes that happen? How many renegade bad cops are there? Because it was like all over the country. That opened the door, and that's one of the things that I think made it very powerful. But it wasn't systemic fully. because it didn't make the connections between policing and schools. For example, punishment in schools if you're African American and you do some infraction that's either suspendable or any other kind of punishment. The degree to which it matters whether you're white or black, male or female, is profound. Something like in Boston in 2012, you were like 52 times more likely to be expelled for actions if you were a black male than if you were a white male student. So you're looking at pushing kids out as a normal consequence of the practice of a punishment policy that appears race neutral.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard multiple times every weekend on SiriusXM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist and the author of 21 books. And our guest this week is Brown University professor Tricia Rose, whose new book is Meta-Racism: How Systemic Racism Devastates Black Lives and How We Can Break Free. Well, and this, all of these dynamics take, they manifest themselves in the particular case of Trayvon Martin.
Right.
You write pretty unequivocally that this was not a chance encounter. This
right.
wasn't just dumb luck that Trayvon Martin right. and the man who killed him happened to be in the same spot.
Right.
This was the product of a system, from disciplinary functions in schools through the
right.
economic realities of real estate
right.
outside of Orlando. Could you walk us and our audience
yeah.
through that a little bit?
Yeah, this was a challenge with the book, because I thought, you know, I don't want a theory book on systems. I want people to feel what it means to live in a world that produces all these seemingly, these powerful obstacles that are invisible, both to you as an African American and to the people around you. Trayvon and his parents didn't have a systems analysis. They
right.
just know what it means to deal with it, right?
Right.
The outcome. So what I started noticing was that people would say things like, there's a People magazine that was very vivid on this, saying it was a chance encounter. If Trayvon had been 10 more minutes in getting Skittles, he maybe wouldn't have run into George Zimmerman. Or if he hadn't gone out that night. Or if he hadn't gotten suspended from school in Dade County. And I started looking into that, and others had done this too, but not in this systemic way, sort of saying, well, why was he suspended? And, you know, a lot of media stories were saying that he was suspended because he's a bad kid, right? He was actually a very good student, you know, and he was an invested student. But he had been charged with infractions by the school. He was charged with punishment for infractions that were not in the guidebook for infractions. So they basically hyper-punished him from the top, so that when he got to the third big punishment, he was able to be suspended for a long period of time. But the first one isn't even punishable, which was truancy,
yeah.
right? And so basically they created a hyper-punishment system, which was already in place in general, to put him in harm's way in particular. He wouldn't have been at his dad's house at all, right? And that, so that punishment system that's happening in Dade County, which is also happening locally in the schools in southern Florida, were not going to make any difference. They're happening everywhere. And so then what I do is build out, well, here's why it's not luck. It's, in fact, a system that puts people in these positions and then says they're random and individual. There was also real estate changes. There's too many details for our
yeah.
time here. But it's a way of saying, look, people come into these chance encounters not with a pre-existing individual racist, but with a system that's driving them into a conflict-based interaction and creates harm for some and advantages for others as they weave their way through. So, for example, he used Stand Your Ground, even though they said, you know, George Zimmerman, even though in the case they said it wasn't applicable.
Right.
The jury said on CNN to Anderson Cooper, I think, one of the jury members said, we were pretty sure we were using Stand Your Ground. It was said every day in the court. So they were using the idea that Zimmerman was afraid of Trayvon, the black kid in a hoodie,
yeah.
and he had a reason to be afraid of him. And therefore, you know, even though we're not legally supposed to use it here, it's going to work on us unconsciously. That's why I asked at the outset of our show, could Trayvon have shot him, turned around and said, this man's following me, he's got a gun?
Right.
I would shoot him if I was scared and dark at night and I carried a gun, which I don't. You know what I mean? But so that all of that comes together, and you're like, this isn't chance. This is kind of a very big likelihood that this happens, and it's happening now. It doesn't change just because, Zimmerman is gone.
You mentioned CNN and People, and many other media outlets, of course, covered Trayvon Martin.
Of course.
Why did so many not, quote unquote, dig deeper to find some of the larger issues at play here? And this is true still of coverage of events.
Yeah, it's not. Mm-hmm. It's just not limited to the
Trayvon
Martin case.
No, limited to that case, 12 years ago.
Any number of things, right. So the first reason is not about race for me. The first reason is that media in our country is about storytelling. And we want storytelling with a character. We want a vivid story with an extreme, easy situation. That's the way we define, not this fantastic show.
But thank you.
I'm just giving us an exception here, a footnote.
But
the typical, right, is that people want a quick, who's good, who's bad, what happened. They want a highly emotional moment.
Yeah.
And they want something that is clear, simple, and has a villain.
And that's true for social media,
which is how a lot
of people consume their news.
It could be on anything, right? It could be any number of things. No point in even listing. So, but when you deal with the racial context, there is a very significant anxiety among some in the political spectrum. Most of them are more conservative than not, but they're not only. So I would say most of the spectrum has participants in it that believe that if we focus on racism as a system, then the country will be responsible. And that responsibility will change the entire political dynamic about pretending that we're a colorblind society, that any kind of effort to redress discrimination is actually going to create more discrimination, which is what they're saying now. But if we prove, which I think there's ample evidence, that society generates racial inequality and sustains it and increases it without having signs on the bathrooms, without having laws that require racism, it produces systemic discrimination. But that's what the whole DEI attack is about right now, that it's reverse racism, that it's actually disadvantaging whites because it doesn't favor them, basically. So that's what's at stake. When you say why, it's because it would change the entire formula of what we think of as actionable in a context of society.
So, this is 2024, it's a presidential election year.
I know.
And I think about the context of this book against that backdrop.
Yeah.
From the hyperventilation about critical race theory a couple of years ago to the recent attack on the AP course on African American studies.
Mm-hmm.
Could you position your book against that backdrop?
Yeah, sure.
What's the dialogue it's having with that environment?
Well, the book's been only out, it's a poor little baby now. It's been out for about, maybe 6 weeks or something. Maybe 6 weeks. So it's not interacting yet as much as I'd like it to with the mainstream.
We'll hopefully do something about that here.
Let's do it. I mean, I think why it's so important is because what I'm saying is that we have to reconsider how we think about race and racism in America. And I actually believe that my argument invites every group of people, white, brown, yellow, green, purple, into the conversation because I'm not blaming individuals. I'm not saying, you're going to have an advantage compared to me or compared to another African American, but you're not going around promoting that. Maybe you are, but maybe you're not. You see what I mean? So you can be an ally.
Right.
We can talk systems and work together as we were doing before the show started. But they want the narrow box of racism is when someone harms you personally and individually intentionally. Because that box is this big compared to the box of mass incarceration and its racial effects.
But it lets people off the hook.
It not only does it let everybody else off the hook, we can say what? The three of us, we're not racist. Right. That one horrible person who called so-and-so a name, they're racist.
Right.
Well, no, wait a minute. That's an individual value problem, but there's a whole set of factors. So for me, when the AP curriculum gets challenged by Florida, and they were targeting specifically any language that related to a critical race analysis and anything with systems. They erased 19, I think it was, expressions of systems in the curriculum. Now, I hear that was revised, so there's been a battle. But the fact that they want that out means they don't even want a creative thinking about how to solve this problem as a society-wide issue because they don't want it to be understood as a society-wide issue.
We've got about 2 minutes left.
Oh, that's a shame.
But the book ends.
We say that to ourselves.
I know, you must be frustrated by that.
The book ends with some thoughts about how we actually can move beyond this.
Right. So for me, what's happened is, remember I started this conversation with my students in class growing more and more unaware of racism as a practice, as a societal organization. And I decided that when I realized, hey, how, what am I going to tell people what they should do with this problem? I realized that if I give advice about go to your school board meeting, protest, write new, you know, something or another, it, like, that's very small. It's big and important to do, but it's not the overall picture. So I started thinking, you know what, we need a paradigm shift. Because a paradigm shift means we're not going to look for just individual crime. We're going to figure out what's really going on. What is the bigger picture? Let's examine this, the local, and then bring it up a notch, and look and see, well, wait a minute. There's these bigger things going on, and we can do that together. I really feel strongly that when many people who are white see this, they'll realize that they're not personally responsible for this in the way that this individual claim of racism is. So for me, the end was, hey, we have to think differently about this. We have to think collectively, but we also have to be honest, and we have to do some hard work. It's not going to be looking for one racist. That's not going to change what we have created.
Well, that's a hugely important work, and we're so grateful to you for spending some time with us now. So, Tricia Rose, the book is Meta-Racism. Thank you so much. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on social media or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.